All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
Yes, welcome to Veterans Radio. Bob Gould, that's right. I'm the one behind the big mic today, and Dale's my partner. He's sitting right there across from me.
Yeah, boy, oh boy.
How you doing? Hey, it's 2018.
It is. Happy New Year, Bob.
Happy New Year to you. Yes. And we also have another guest with us today. Happy New Year to you, Tom Wright.
Happy New Year to you.
And I want to say Happy New Year and thank you for being listeners all in 2017, all of our listeners, all of our great fans. Keep those cards and letters coming in. That would be really cool. And we look forward to you know what we got today?
What
the fourth
do we have
year,
today?
Fourth year in a row, Dr. Rebecca Grant. She what did we get not too long ago? More Rebecca.
Yeah, that's the things we get. It's nice. Too bad she doesn't live closer. We could have her on all the time.
Oh, we could have her right here. Oh, yes. But she is here in spirit.
She is here. That's right. We want her to be involved with us as we hopefully when we move forward and give her own program someday.
Right here as part of Veterans Radio.
That's
sure.
Right.
Give her a whole 1 hour, do it, and oh, wow, that'd be exciting. We'll have to find out what that's all about. Okay, we got some news. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of sad events, I guess you could say, is number one is that, and Bob can't do this himself, so I'll do it. Back in 2004, a young woman from Taylor, Michigan was probably the first female, I believe, that was killed in the Iraq War, and that was Holly McGough. And so we just want to honor her memory today. That's it's been 11 years, almost 12
2004.
Years. 2004. Right. So anyway, and I know that her family is still thinking about her every day, and I hope everybody else does. It's going to get a chance. I know he's got something he wanted to read. Go ahead.
I wanted to mention Holly McGough because she was from Taylor, Michigan. She went to Truman High School. She was one cool gal, folks. When we talk about our youth, she was really something. She was killed January 31st when her vehicle was hit by a IED. And, you know, you and I have seen those, man. They just get blown to smithereens. There were two others with her. And she was the first woman from Michigan to be killed in Iraq. And maybe next week we can get her mom on. But I want to read this. She said, her last letter to her mother arrived the same day that the officers came to tell her mother that her daughter was gone.
Wow.
So she got her last letter. And in that, Holly said, if she were to die, we should remember that she died for a reason. Holly will always be remembered as a very, very brave soldier. Holly McGough, rest in peace.
Okay. Pause for a
That's
second.
Hard.
I know. Those are always
That's
hard. Because
hard, man.
Because you went down there. I remember we. You did,
I was
you
there,
went there
for the funeral.
For their funeral, and we did a broadcast from there. Anyway, with a connection from you. The other one that we just wanted to make sure that people remember, and that was John Young. And John Young is an astronaut who passed away on the 5th on Friday. He walked on the moon, which is kind of awesome right there in itself.
Yeah.
But he's also the one of the pilots of commanded the first shuttle flight. He passed away. He was 85 years old, which is hard to believe that our heroes from growing up, you know, all those astronauts that were just the best of the best of the finest and so forth, you know, have been passing away. And it's, you know, there's great pictures in all the newspapers or online of him, you know, in the uniform.
It was just a small article, just a little tiny article in the Free Press today. I was surprised at that. He was also the only astronaut. He wasn't one of the original seven, but he was in Gemini and Apollo and walked on the moon.
Right.
Did I miss one there?
Yeah,
was Gemini.
The shuttle.
And the shuttle, right.
Right.
I mean, Talk about a great American. Gosh darn, John Young.
Yep.
God bless you, man.
And you know, it's the rumors are out there that they want to, you know, restart up the astronaut program again. So I'm excited to hear more about that in the future. And actually, maybe Rebecca might have a comment to make about that because she knows what's going on. She's right there all the time. But
was he Navy? Was he Navy or Air Force? I don't think we had any Air Force astronauts, did we?
No, it says he joined the Navy. He was on a destroyer before becoming a pilot in 1959, and then he joined the NASA program. Spent 835 hours in space. Served as chief astronaut from 74 to 87. Retired in 2004. That's a lot of hours in space.
Okay,
wow.
Getting right along. By the way, folks, okay. If your children or relatives or whatever, niece, nephew, are in Metropolitan Airport, you want to be sure and tell them about the Freedom Center. That's there. We don't have a USO in Detroit. Did anybody know that? No, we don't.
Left.
Oh, I know. I'm not supposed to do that. Did it again. Anyway, so we did it ourselves. You're darn right. Soldiers did. Veterans did. They put this thing together. It's called the Freedom Center. It's been going 2 years. It's there at Metropolitan Airport. Also, if you know someone that's wheelchair-bound and their special assistance when they're flying, the TSA will meet you at the door of the airport, get you through security, and then to your gate. Okay.
It's called Accommodating Wounded Warriors is the program that's there. And you have to notify TSA in advance in order for them to offer that service to you. And there's a phone number here and an email. So let's give you the phone number, right?
Yep.
So remember, Bob always says, make sure you have a pen.
Crayon, anything.
888-262-2396. That's 888-262-2396. Or you can email the Gov. It says email is MSUSOC. That's MSUSOC at DHS.gov.
And in case if you didn't get any of this, folks, you can either email Dale or myself, Bob@VeteransRadio.net, Dale@VeteransRadio.net. Be sure you do .net. That's really a cool thing, the TSA, to do that.
Yeah.
Look at how things are changing, man. That's so cool.
For the better.
It's about time. Anything else looking good on announcements?
I'm just looking here at upcoming events, just a couple of them. Local veterans organizations, the DAV Chapter 129, on Wednesday the 10th is coming up here, and that's 129 is hosting a Taste of Italy and movie night at their place in Shelby Township. So look up DAV Chapter 129 for hosting that event, and I think that you'll find that kind of interesting. Taste of Italy and movie night.
I'm going to be there. I'm going to do that. Taste of Italy.
And let's see. The other thing coming up is on next Sunday during the daytime, 2 o'clock, is the Michigan Military Technical and Historical Society is presenting another one of their lecture series on World War II. This time, Politics, Torch, and Casablanca. I understand that Humphrey Bogart is going to be there.
Well, I got something else. I missed that. I'm reading at the same. What did I miss? Tell me again.
No, I just said Humphrey Bogart was going to be at this presentation.
Yes. Okay.
As in Casablanca.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Da, 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 da. Okay. Well, folks, the number in New Jersey to call is Bigelow. No. The U.S. Army versus the Navy. Let's go, Army. Wheelchair basketball game, Saturday, January the 27th, 2018, at Chrysler Arena. Tip-off, 5 o'clock. We're going to be telling you more and more about that. It's really cool stuff. There's going to be music, entertainment, dance band, cheerleading team. Ooh, I like that. The 338th. Army Band. Admission is free, complimentary. That's from the veterans to you. So that's Army-Navy wheelchair basketball game, Saturday, January 27th at Chrysler Arena.
I have to tell you that the U of M is doing a lot of things for their veterans. It's amazing what is going on over there, and you have to do it yourself. Anyway, I just wanted to... a note was passed to me before the beginning of the program. I just wanted to remind folks, hopefully next week we can talk to them about this more, but Dr. Noel Tishy, got it. Sorry, Noel. The Ross School of Business has worked extensively with the veterans. He's managing the Michigan Veterans Initiative, the Veterans Summit, which is gathers corporate leaders nationwide from the top MBA schools and so forth. And he's done over 1,100 workshops to help the VA deliver services to our veterans. And he's also trained over 100 Navy SEALs to be effective leaders. I'm very interested in talking to this gentleman, and hopefully we can get him on the air next week. And, again, that's U of M. Again, as I mentioned, all kinds of activities are going on there. Their Students Veteran Association is very, very active, and there are many events going on almost all the time, and they've got – it's just a great organization. And my understanding is that many of these types of associations and meetings are going on across the country, which is so much better than when you and I were in the service.
Oh, yeah.
When they just kind of said, you know, go away and don't bother us. Yeah. I think it's great what they're doing over there.
Okay, well, that's pretty much news and views coming here at Veterans Radio. We're going to be right back after this very short PSA break, as I tell our board op, right? He's shaking his head. So we're going to be right back with, well, you know who, Dr. Rebecca Grant. Don't go away. There we go. Off you go into the wild blue yonder, and off we go with the Veterans Radio program today. And one of our very, very special guests, we get lots of mail, emails, whatever. Bring back more Rebecca. So we got that. She started the programs for the last, this will be her fourth year. She's doing the Keystone program, our first one for the year. So once again, welcome Dr. Grant to Veterans Radio.
I'm thrilled to be back with you, Bob and Dale.
And we are thrilled to have you back.
Thank you.
Dale's got this real neat bio, right? Go ahead. It's better than the one I got.
I'm sure that you've heard this before. But Dr. Grant is a national security analyst based in Washington. She earned her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics at age 25 last summer. And then worked for RAND and was on the staff of the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Since founding her independent research company of her own, she specializes in research for government aerospace industry clients ranging from analysis of military campaigns to projects on major new technology. She has written over 100 articles for Air Force Magazine. This is my favorite part. Appears regularly on the Smithsonian Channel, Fox Business Network, Fox News, CNN, Veterans Radio, and other media outlets talking about air power and national security. Lives in Washington, D.C. Husband, daughter, spends her leisure time with thoroughbreds, racehorses off the track. Has flown in Air Force T-38s, E-3, AWACS, B-52, F-16s, Aggressor, F-15s, and has a Harley Davidson. So what else you need to know?
Yeah, right. I remember, folks, I got one quick Dr. Rebecca anecdote. When I was talking with her when she first came on our program, and we were just talking off air, and she was talking about, well, I took my bike through Washington. I said, me too. I got a Schwinn. What do you have? And she told me. Well, anyway, welcome, Dr. Grant.
Well, I am delighted to be here, and what a lot of international news we've seen over the past year, and it's just going to be more of the same in 2018. So many big, big themes coming up, and I hope we get to talk about Russia and China and the national security strategy. Where do we start, gentlemen?
All right. Well, we got one other thing that I had for sure from North Korea. You're going to get a scoop here, folks. That's right. So you get your pen and ink and get ready to get going. So where do we start? The national security strategy, President Trump, tell us all about his top goals and what has that meant?
So back in a couple weeks ago in December, President Trump released his first national security strategy. Presidents typically do this. is, like everything else, is different from what we've seen before. And he had four major points. One was to protect the homeland, the American people, American way of life. His second pillar is promote American prosperity. And there's a lot in there that we need to talk about because it really goes to the economic basis of national security. So that's pillar two. And pillar three is to preserve peace through strength. We hear echoes of Ronald Reagan and also of George Washington in that peace through strength phrase. And what he means there is the improvements that he wants to see in the military, funding, readiness, and getting ready for some of the challenges of mid-21st century warfare, which includes space, cyberspace, all that. And beyond this, there's a fourth pillar called enhancing and advancing American influence. So, you know, some of it is what we always expect, talking about working with allies, a strong military, but there's some very, very new twists to this national security strategy as well.
I was just going to ask, could you go into that economic thing that you mentioned on pillar two?
Yeah, that's the one that's really fresh. You know, we all know that you have to be a strong nation to have a strong military, but this strategy puts that first and foremost. And when Trump spoke at the Reagan building in Washington a few weeks ago to roll out the strategy, this was the area that he really emphasized. I think you see his New York business background, but there's also a much longer view here, and that is the Trump administration is trying to get America ready for a really long-term competition with China. And the premise is that to succeed in that competition, our economy has to be very strong. Now, you know, you've seen Ian during the campaign and during his first year in office, he's made a lot of remarks about, oh, NATO has to pay their share and, you know, you can't just have this system, you need to pay for it. There's been a lot of fireworks over this issue. The new strategy really says we have to have prosperity in order to fund our strong military.
Right.
It's really interesting to see where we are, I think, at this point, you know, with the U.S. and China and some of the world economy.
I think, you know, from a historical perspective, you can go back to the Reagan years when we outspent the Russians so much, we drove them into bankruptcy.
Yeah, where they still pretty much are in
right.
a way. And you know, right now, the U.S. still has the world's largest economy. And according to the World Bank, our economy is about $18.5 trillion per year. But China has the fastest growing economy. They're a little bit behind us at about $11.2 trillion. So $18 trillion for us, $11 trillion for them, according to the World Bank. But a key difference between the U.S. and China right now is that our U.S. GDP growth, our year-over-year growth in gross domestic product. That's a measure that tells you the health and the strength of your economy. And in 2015, 2016, we were growing at about 1.6% per year. And that's low.
Mm-hmm.
Now, China can't always trust these numbers because of the society that they have. But according to the World Bank, they're growing at about 6% a year. So even if that's a little exaggerated, the basic point is China's economy is growing more quickly than ours. And we see that kind of echoed across our European allies, where a country like Britain, for example, much smaller economy, but similar 1.8 GDP growth. So, you know, part of the Trump national security strategy is to boost the growth so that we can stay keep up with and stay ahead of China.
Well, getting back, let's get to China because, I mean, first of all, one thing I heard about Germany, Hitler, he had no budget, folks, none, zero. In fact, I think the Reichstag only met once or twice while he was in power. But what they would do is that somebody who, like Goering, what would have an idea, and that's where the money went. Well, do we have the same thing? Number one question, do we have that in China? And if otherwise, where does the wealth come from? Do they have a budget, and do people pay taxes? Tell us about that.
Yeah, China, they have a budget, they declare numbers, but there's a lot of suspicion because they are still controlled by the Communist Party. It's a one-party system. Their leader, Xi Jinping, is the head of the Chinese Communist Party and runs the Central Party Committee. The military in China is in business. They have been in business for a long time. They not only build weapons, they sell them. They also own hotels and real estate and high-tech companies. So it's very, very mixed and mingled. There's no separation between the military and the industrial sector in the way that we see here. So, you know, so while we look at these fabulous growth numbers, we can't be sure that they're as strictly reported as the ones in the Western economies where there's a lot of law and regulation that makes sure that, you know, when you say this is your growth rate, that's what it really is. But that said, there's no question that they're, you know, they're doing well because of the emphasis on trade and business, bringing them back to really where they always were historically.
When I'm looking at this and I see are they gaining? Does China wants to be our friend? That's the way I see it, folks. And regardless of what Mao did, he was a gangster, according to my very close friend who is Chinese. But I see that China is putting these economic ties with us like little tendrils. I mean, they might not have to have diplomats, folks, but when it comes to North Korea, China wields a big stick, and especially about what's going to happen there. Tell us about that.
Oh, they certainly do. China is North Korea's biggest trading partner. They control about 93% of the trade with North Korea. So they are really, really essential there. And for China, North Korea is a huge test case. China, under their leader Xi Jinping, wants to be recognized as a major international power. They have the economy to do it. They have the military to do it now. But they have on their border this menace to the entire planet called North Korea. And they've spent most of the past year trying to figure out how to deal with this madman, Kim Jong-un. China is really, really essential. They, for instance, control a lot of the internet access into North Korea. They supply a lot of the oil. There was a big incident recently where a Chinese ship was caught smuggling oil to North Korea. We don't know now whether that was gangs and illegal activity or Chinese military activity, but the basic point is, you know, as China goes, so goes North Korea. So we've seen this year an unfolding of the U.S. stepping into the role of bad cop, military pressure, change in policy, while hoping that China will go in and try to negotiate. There's been quite a bit of attempt by China to do this, and we're waiting to see what unfolds. We've got some important diplomatic conference coming up next week in Vancouver, and then, of course, the Olympics in South Korea. So we'll see if some progress will be made. But China is absolutely essential there, and they just, you know, for a while, it was fine to let North Korea harass the United States and Australia and other countries. But now, with the offensive capability that Kim Jong-un is building, it's just too much of a menace. China can't be that great power they want to be as long as Kim Jong-un is pursuing that offensive nuclear ballistic missile capability.
We have less than a minute to go before halfway, and but I want to get this in. Folks, as we've been covering North Korea here at Veterans Radio for over a year, one of the things I want to emphasize is that, you know, when you got North Korea, folks, that's a border for China. I mean, they don't have to really defend that. So they're not going to give that up very easily, folks. China's not going to let anybody go pushing around things to happen in places like North Korea. Tell us about that.
In fact, that's right. China has actually tightened up their border, and Russia has a little tiny border with North Korea. They've posted more guards there as well. So one of the big questions is they don't want to see a flood of North Korean refugees coming across that border. So China has really, really tightened up there, but we want to see what further pressure they're willing to do. Remarkable this year, China has cooperated at the UN all year in putting strict sanctions on North Korea. So we continue to see the UN Security Council ratchet up those sanctions, and so far, China and Russia are on board with us in tightening sanctions on North Korea.
I still want to know, why can't China hold a bigger stick over North Korea? Real quick, we got about a minute. I mean, I want to cover that.
And it goes back to Mao. There's a famous story about Mao and Khrushchev throwing up their hands and saying, how can we deal with Kim Jong-un's grandfather, right? So it's just very, very hard to know how to put that pressure on. They want to pressure Kim, but they don't want to collapse the regime and create a refugee crisis or drive us into war. Very delicate, tricky balance.
Exactly. I mean, you can see similarities between this almost in Syria. You know, you want to get rid of Assad, but if you get rid of Assad, who comes in and takes over, and what happens to the people that actually live there?
Yeah, and I want to, next we want to cover Russia, right after the break. I mean, they always, they're like a bad cold. They always show up here and there, right? I mean, they're awful. We're going to be right back with Dr. Grant. The band is warming up. No, they're not warming up. We got 10 seconds. We'll be right back. You listen to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600. Don't go away. Yeah, we're back here on Veterans Radio. That was Sounder, folks. Hey, man, what is that break music you? Sounder, that's what we call it. Anyway, Dale, you want to give out the phone number?
I just I want to give out the phone number. If you have a question for Dr. Grant, please give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. Simple as that. Dr. Grant, I had a quick question. I noticed in the news this morning I saw that the USS Wasp was sailing into the Sea of Japan, and this has, I can't remember the number of the aircraft, was it F-35s?
Yes, this is very exciting. The USS Wasp is an amphibious ship, which means you'd think of it as a little carrier, and they have F-35s aboard. It's a Marine Corps, this is Marine Corps F-35s, along with the helicopters. These carriers used to have the Harriers, and they're replacing them with F-35s. It's the variant that can take off vertically from the deck, so very exciting. And this is no accident. The F-35 is our newest fighter jet. It has tremendous intelligence capabilities as well as sensors and weapons, and it is just no accident that we've got that deployed forward over in the Sea of Japan. So hats off to the Marines for taking the F-35 to war. Good going.
My understanding in the article I read with it is that the North Koreans do not have radar that can detect the F-35.
That's right. It's a long explanation, but the F-35 is designed to evade the radar typically used in integrated air defenses. They use stealth and some electronic warfare and lots of other magic and smart pilots, both male and female, to fly that jet. Mm-hmm. And so it poses a real threat to North Korea. It's just one other way that we've used our military forces from all the branches to keep North Korea on notice over the past year. Don't forget, we have 28,000 Americans stationed in South Korea. That's mostly Army and Air Force. Of course, mm-hmm. Navy, 7th Fleet in the area, the Marines as well. We've also had F-35s from the Air Force forward to Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa in Japan for a couple of months now. So we continue to put the good stuff through so that Kim Jong-un knows that we can do things to his target set that he hasn't even dreamed of should he get out of line. And this is an important rotation of our military forces to maintain relations with our allies in the region, our treaty allies, and to keep that pressure on North Korea, drive them to the negotiating table.
Well, we hope so. We hope so. Go ahead, Bob. You wanted to move to Russia.
I guess I want to segue right into, because I'm a little annoyed with how much military protection we provide for Japan. I think it's time Japan starts taking some of those old Toyotas, melting them, doing something else on their own instead of relying, Toyotas, Nissan, rice burners, whatever. I shouldn't say that. But So here we are. Where do we stand with Japan? Are we finally going to be cutting them loose? What is the story on that?
Yeah, it's great to talk about Japan because things have changed there a bit, and they have a very, very active and very professional military. As we say, they live in a bad neighborhood. North Korea has been lofting missiles over Japan since the late 90s. So Japan has a very professional navy. It's part of the Japan Self-Defense Force. They have advanced radar on board their ships that help us with missile defense. So the U.S. and the Japanese constantly have forces out on, if I can use the phrase, the picket line, which helps watch for a launch from North Korea. And depending on the type of missile it would be, these ships are capable of using sea-based missile defense to defend Japan and other areas. Also, Japan's Air Force, which goes by the phrase Kokojetai, very, very active. You would not believe what goes on in the skies around Japan. They are constantly being assaulted by Chinese fighter planes and Russian fighter planes. They will do 1,000 intercepts a year there. And these are not just, hey, waving from the cockpit. We are hearing stories from Japan that sometimes the Russian or Chinese jets come really close. There's turning and yanking and banking, as the fighter pilots say. We've seen cases where chaff and flares are released to say, hey, buddy, you're too close, back off. So Japan has a very, very professional air force, and they're very busy at this point. They actually had to move some of their forces a little bit south in order to be able to cover that area out over the Sea of Japan a bit better and have better radar coverage and better ability to go and intercept these jets that fly around all the time. I can't imagine living in the U.S. and having that kind of Russian and Chinese fighter activity at the border every day. It's crazy. They're doing a great job.
Well, we talked about, thank you for that one, because I'm following that, and I know that a lot of our listeners have really got a heads up on that. Here's something, folks. Here's a scoop, a Veterans Radio scoop that we're now going to introduce, and I don't think a whole lot of people know about this. One more time, we're going to still deal with North Korea. They have anthrax and bioweapons programs. Let me say that again, anthrax and bioweapons programs. This is the North Koreans. It's a big thing going on out there, folks. Tell us about that.
Oh, this is so scary. In fact, there's a great report that came out from Harvard University back in October that lays it out. We also get a lot of information from South Korea, and here's what South Korea has to say. North Korea has about 13 different bioagents in production. That includes anthrax, smallpox, and a whole bunch of other things that I can't even pronounce. Now, the question is, can they weaponize these bioagents? You know, we know that a lot of countries in the past have produced anthrax. The example I always think of is Iraq under Saddam Hussein back in the 1991 Gulf War. They had about 8,000 gallons of anthrax, and we thought that they had at least a few short-range Russian Scud missiles with special warheads into which the anthrax could be put. Our coalition attacked all that. The air campaign attacked those bioweapon sites, and nothing ever came of it. But we know it can be done. And, you know, Bob, back in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't hard to get anthrax for, quote, research purposes. So we know that they have a pretty active program in North Korea. What the South says is they think that they could militarize a small batch of anthrax or of smallpox within about 10 days. And, of course, there recently was a defector from North Korea who turned up in South Korea and had anthrax antibodies in his blood. So that means to me either he was vaccinated, he was a soldier, he was vaccinated, or he was exposed, maybe as part of an experiment, horrible, creepy. Possibly he was handling farm animals or infected hides, but as a soldier, I think that's less likely. So we have pretty good evidence that the North has a bioagent program, and it's just one more thing that we have to worry about. And frankly, for me, it's one more reason why this maniac has been allowed to go on too long. We have to stop this before he gets more ballistic missiles, before he goes out and develops or purchases cruise missiles or hypersonics. This is just a guy who can't, you know, he's not just a dictator with a couple weapons to keep his regional adversaries at bay. This is a dictator developing an offensive capability, and that's why the UN is so firm in trying to bring him to the negotiating table and denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
We're going to take a break and give you a break in just a second, but I got one more question, and I really want to put this forth to you, Dr. Grant. Okay, you're the president. And this situation is going on with bioweapons in North Korea. What the heck do you do?
Well, I think we're doing the right thing. You know, we've got a, the best thing I've seen this year is how closely we're working with all our allies in the region and at the UN Security Council. So we are making it clear that we want to negotiate with Kim Jong-un and have him ratchet down those programs. The one thing we can do, diplomacy, constant, quiet, and keep our military pressure on. So I think we're on the right course, scary as it is.
Okay, we're taking a break right now. A little PSA, short message, Dr. Grant, please have a little tea or something, and we're going to be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 WAAM. Yeah, we're back on Veterans Radio. Of course, you all know what that is. That is the Air Force theme. Off we go into the wild blue yonder and touch the face of God. Whew, boy, that's always something. Okay, now we talk about the thugs in the world, the thugs in Europe, the Russians. Yes, they do. They're always, they don't really do anything themselves. They just go around causing a lot of trouble because they think that's how they can have influence. Why? Because they don't have much of an economy. People are standing in cheese lines at Red Square. And, oh man, here's Russia. They're now trying to get in North Korea. Who knows? China, what? How, why does Putin, and by the way, we've told Putin to stay Putin. And I think he should on that. But why does he hold a losing hand? Tell us about that.
Oh, and the success of the West and NATO, it just drives Putin bananas. You know, he was a KGB officer back before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then he was a Yeltsin man. And he just wants to see Russia as the world leader. But here's why he has a losing hand long term. One, the economy. So I told earlier about the U.S. economy being about $18 trillion a year. Russia's is estimated at maybe between $2 and $3 trillion a year, much, much less. The price of oil really affects his economy as well. When oil is down, that's bad for the Russians. The economy is still subject to a great deal of corruption. Talk about gangs and gangsters. Oh, my goodness. And perhaps worst of all, while our growth rate isn't as much as we'd like, Russia is actually close to a recession. They had almost a negative GDP growth last year. The population of Russia has never truly recovered from World War II, from the demographics. It's an aging population, and the economic strength just isn't there. So what Putin does to stay in power is to go create trouble around the world. You know, he wants to see Russia in its expansionist empire, and, you know, hats off. It's a great culture in many ways, wonderful art and literature and music that's come out of Russia. But Putin has some pretty grand ideas. But it's been a bad year for Putin. Trump is not what he was expecting at all. NATO has added to its membership. The war in Syria is coming to an end. Now, Putin has really taken advantage of the last 3 years. He set up a Russian Air Force base at Latakia in Syria, which is a lovely, you know, Mediterranean base. He has rotated most of his Air Force units through that base so that they'll get a little bit of combat experience. What they do to get that combat experience is they harass the U.S. and our coalition allies. They have the same types of jets as the Syrians because they provided them, so they fly around and fly where they're not supposed to be and generally make a huge nuisance of themselves on a daily basis. So, you know, they really have been showing off. They've put an integrated air defense system, of course, at their base in Syria. Then there's Ukraine, which, of course, they annexed a chunk of Ukraine by taking over the Crimea a few years ago, and Ukraine remains an issue. Not many people noticed it, but the president did last month decide that he would give some additional aid, military aid, to Ukraine. Congress had wanted to do this for a few years, and the White House had said no, but Trump and Tillerson have now said that they will provide some lethal aid to Ukraine. It looks like it'll take the form primarily of anti-tank weapons. And the idea is to make sure Ukraine can defend its borders a little bit better and isn't likely to be overrun by the Russians.
Ooh. Well, I've got a question. Dale, do you have something here?
No, I'm just fascinated by all this information that we always gather whenever Rebecca is on the program, and it's just so helpful for all of us to understand what is going on in the world because we don't necessarily get these stories.
And put it all in so concise and a great – oh, I love – well, here's my question, and we're going to just finish this off with Russia, and then we'll take another little break. But where do they get their wealth from? And do they have a Politburo budget as our taxes? Tell us about that.
Yes, they do. No, they have tremendous oil resources, manufacturing, tremendous agriculture sector. It's just never been as well organized as it might be. And you remember all the ups and downs of their economy throughout Russian history. They also now have, in the 90s, they were very, very low, and partly how they came back was through some, you know, almost Al Capone unscrupulous businessmen. A lot of oligarchs, a lot of, of real shenanigans in the business world there. That means that the daily lifestyle for some Russians, it's very uneven. So you've got the real rich and the others that aren't doing as well. But overall, they just are slowly falling behind. They can't achieve the growth in manufacturing or in trade. And since they're such a commodity-dependent country with oil, when oil is down in price, it really affects them. So just very hard. Now, they do have, of course, tremendous natural gas reserves and supply much of Europe's natural gas, which is a huge issue for that region of the world as well. But it's just not a winning hand, which is why Putin is trying so hard to play the cards he has dealt now to keep Russia up in that top tier. He's even hoping to get a pipeline down from Vladivostok through North Korea at some point, which could be good if that gets him to the table. Keeps Russia on board, that's helpful. So he's looking for every angle economically, militarily, and they're really a problem. We've had to put more forces in Poland to enhance deterrence for NATO. So that shows you, you know, what a nuisance Putin really is.
If they go ahead, the Russians, I'm just thinking about this, folks. They put a pipeline through North Korea, and there's a little skirmish, whatever, and we disrupt that. Is that provocation?
Well, I think this would happen, you know, if North Korea kind of comes to its senses and opens up at some point in time. And in a way, it could be a good thing. You know, the more international actors we have in there to put pressure on this, the better. Russia's always been part of the six-party talks. So they've been relatively helpful for them with North Korea so far. I hope they will be. But their overall ambitions are tough. And, of course, what are they the best at? Propaganda and information warfare. They do a tremendous job at that, and they're really very, very disruptive.
We're still involved with that.
Yes.
I had a quick question of Russian nuclear weapons when Russia collapsed, or when the old Soviet Union collapsed. Was there a full accounting of whatever nuclear weapons that they had, or has Russia been selling them off to highest bidders?
Oh, they're a pretty good accounting of the strategic weapons, but they had, Dale, a lot of tactical nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. thousands, literally thousands. We've put some effort into making sure they're mostly accounted for. Interesting point, you know who gave up their nuclear weapons? Ukraine. They had quite a few when they became independent, and they went ahead and denuclearized completely. And they've recently said, oh, gosh, we wish we hadn't
done
it.
Yeah, what were we thinking?
I'm glad they did. But we think we know where most of the Russian weapons are, but hard to say.
Okay. And I had recently read a fictional novel that talked about that.
Yeah.
Where
did they go?
Yeah, you know, people were trying to buy them off.
You don't
of,
have
off
one.
Of the, no, not in my house. But the idea was that bad guys were trying to buy these things to cause problems in the rest of the world. And, you know, it seemed realistic. I mean, it was so realistic it scared me when I was reading this book.
Well, okay, we're going to go to a break real quick. But, that begs this question then. Does Russia have the morality to not sell these atomic weapons to the bad folks? What do you think about that, Dr. Grant?
I think Putin wants to keep them, but can you account for every last one? That's the question. That's the the book Dale read. That's that's the scary thing. Do we have accounting of every last one? But right now, Putin wants them for himself.
Well, we're going to, Dale, anything?
Go ahead. No, take a break.
No, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. A single PSA, don't go away, WAAM Talk Radio 1600. And we're back here on Veterans Radio with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Well, a whole lovely list of things that we could be talking about today, and one of them caught Dale in my attention, and I saw it on television recently, and that's war in space. Yes, Star Wars? Well, I don't know. But I saw a a military plane that takes off in regular, how do we want to say this, takes off from the Earth, right, and then goes into suborbit and then comes back out of orbit to attack. Have you heard of that, Dale?
I have heard of it, but I think our expert will fill it in.
I know. So, Dr. Grant, tell us about that.
Well, you know, you may be referring to an experimental plane called the Boeing X-37. Which is, it's small, but it has the incredible distinction of having stayed on orbit for a very, very, very long time. You know, in fact, about 2 years. It's under an Air Force experiment. They declined to say exactly what it's doing, but there are many ideas. And, you know, the question is, at what point do your bombers become not just air breathing, high altitude B-52s and B-2s that fly up to, you know, somewhere 40, 50,000 feet, but at what point do you get a vehicle that goes through near space and up even higher? And what are the advantages? And of course, one of the advantages, if you also combine that with a hypersonic speed, is it opens up a whole different way to attack key strategic targets. So I think there's a lot of experimentation and thought going on. I think what's really new here, too, is we've seen in the last few years our Air Force leaders and national leaders say, hey, you know, it's not about war in space. It's just that war will now include the space dimension. So there's no question that we see a lot more competition. You know, at one point it was just us and the Russians up in space. Now we have many, many countries who have satellites, and the Chinese are very active in space. My goodness, even North Korea has launched a satellite and talk about wanting to do more. We are very dependent on space as a domain for our transflow of information, both communications, you know, voice or text communications and imagery and all that entails. So we're very space dependent. We rely on our global positioning system, satellites, GPS, for our phones and banking and everything we do. That's doubled in the military. Our militaries have been practicing what they call a day without space for quite a while, where they try to go back and fight without having to have constant use of space systems. They plan for interruption or degradation of space assets. But it really, really is something that's new. And, you know, a satellite moving around the Earth, if it bumps into another satellite, you have a potential offensive capability. It's just a fact.
Wow. Well, I just wanted to ask you one final question, Dr. Grant. And that was, you know, with the current administration, there's lots of talk out there about, you know, just a lot of things. Lack of security, I guess. And you had a comment in your email to us that you thought that General Mattis was doing, was a great Secretary of Defense. I was wondering if you could tell us why you feel that way.
Oh, absolutely. Concerns were raised about appointing a retired Marine four-star general so soon after his retirement. He had to get a waiver from Congress, right, in fact, to take the job. But I think everyone in Washington, regardless of party politics, gives Jim Mattis high grades as Secretary of Defense. One, he is no-nonsense. The press corps asked him if he was impressed with North Korea's progress in ballistic missiles in the year 2017, and Mattis said, "Nothing impresses me." You know, he is blunt. He gets asked about, you know, what's going on with North Korea. He gets asked about what's going on at the White House, and he always gives a very blunt, simple, straight answer. But here's what he's really done effectively this year. He changed the tactics for our operations in Syria and Iraq, and they're now moving to try those same tactics in our new strategy for Afghanistan. The change is to allow our American soldiers to get a little bit closer to the firing line with the forces that they're advising, whether it's Syrian, Iraqi, or Afghani. Instead of having to sit kind of back in the brigade tactical operations center, they're allowed to go a little bit closer to where the shooting's actually taking place. That's a large part of the reason that we've wrapped up so much of the ISIS territory in Syria and Iraq this year so successfully, and they're trying the same thing in Afghanistan. That is a Mattis tactic. Mattis also believes in air power. As a one-star Marine, he took his forces in an air assault into Kandahar airfield in Afghanistan. He was backed up by the coalition air component under then the three-star general Buzz Mosley. He knew with that air power behind him, he could air assault his Marines into Kandahar airfield and take it successfully, which he did. So Mattis is a big believer in combining precision air power with our ground forces, and he's proven how effective that can be in Iraq, Syria, and now in Afghanistan. So he's made some tremendous changes, and he is just a straight shooter, no nonsense, highest marks, I think, out of all of Trump's cabinet.
I like that we don't hear about him every day.
No, right. Nice, we certainly part. Don't. Thank you for that, for that appraisal, Dale. We've got less than 2 minutes. You got a quick, very quick say goodbye, or you got 1 minute? So.
I don't want to say. Well, I would. I guess I could ask Dr. Grant, what's next for you?
I am doing some research on autonomous weapons and national security. The Chinese have said they want to catch up to the U.S. in autonomy by the year 2020 and pass us by 2025, so I'm working on that. I'm also starting research for a book on the F-22 in combat, how the fighter was developed, how it went through its growing pains, and then how it's been such a big success and so helpful in Syria and in helping to fend off some of those aggressive Russian jets in the skies over Syria and Iraq. So lots of good stuff coming up. And I continue to do occasional reports on Fox and CNN and other places as the big national security stories come up. And, of course, Veterans Radio. I love you guys.
Okay.
We love you, too. Okay, we got 10 seconds. Well, we didn't get a chance to get to the Ford folks, but we'll get to that next week. 7, 6, well, you listen to Veterans Radio. Until next week, you're dismissed.